An employee doesn't have to prove that they were right about their underlying complaint in order to succeed on a retaliation claim. So let's say I'm at a big firm and I don't make partner. And I go in and I say, I think you voted against me for partner because I'm female. And they say, no, we didn't make you partner this year because you don't have enough of a client base. You know, you can't support your partnership. But we're really disappointed that you think so little of us that we just really can't see you as a future partner. I mean, if you think that we're just all a bunch of male chauvinist pigs, then what hope is there that we could ever be partners? So we think it's time that you leave the firm. Today's your last day, right? So I sue, I claim, one, I wasn't promoted because I'm female, and two, I was retaliated against because I complained. Well, the jury may say, no, you weren't promoted because your numbers weren't big enough, but you were definitely fired because you complained. So you don't have to win on the underlying complaint in order to succeed on a retaliation claim. Keep in mind that, you know, managers who get accused of discrimination or harassment or violating some law, they get frustrated. And juries get that. They understand that. So it's a lot easier for them to believe in retaliation because they think, you know, if I was accused of that, I'd be pissed too. And it'd be really hard for me to be fair to that employee going forward, knowing that they thought so little of me, knowing they thought I was racist or thought I was sexist. So it's an easier case to prove than proving that somebody is racist or sexist, because everybody can identify with the idea of being wrongfully accused pissing you off. Now, maybe they're not wrongfully accused, but most people think they are. Whether they are or they aren't, they think they are. You know, they don't necessarily see it in themselves. But regardless, they're going to be upset. You know, even if they're guilty of sin and they know it, they're going to be upset they got caught, right? So juries can identify with that, and so it's an easier case to prove in that regard. Employees engage in an activity protected by statute. Often they have to have done something like make a complaint to HR or file a charge, file a workers' compensation claim, or go to HR and tell them, I need to file a workers' complaint, or I have a workers' compensation injury, or I've been injured on the job, you know, what are my rights? Or they have to have been interviewed as part of the investigation or testified in a proceeding. So that's their protected activity, right, is the complaining process or the charge process or the participating in the investigation or the testifying. So they have to engage in some protected activity. They don't necessarily have to have done anything formal. They just have to oppose it, right? Say, do something oppositional. Okay, so examples of protected activity. Employee complains to HR that she is being singled out by her supervisor because she's the only woman. Employee answers an EEOC investigator's questions about charge filed by another employee. That person would be protected. The employee informs his supervisor that he needs an accommodation for a mental illness in the form of adjusted schedule and then gets demoted. Employee inquires about whether he is properly classified as exempt and then finds his pay cut, right? So, you know, these are examples where, you know, they've engaged in protected activity and then there's a adverse action and, you know, you have a potential risk. So the employee who suffers an adverse employment action, that's required. They have to have suffered some adverse employment action. So what is that? There has to be a causal connection between the two, between the protected activity and the adverse employment action. So they have to be able to tie the two together. So common evidence to support a claim of retaliation would include knowledge, the employer's knowledge of the protected activity. Very much look at the timing between the complaint and the adverse action. And sometimes that is just horrific. It's just very difficult to get around, even if you can show, you know, even if you feel like you have really strong evidence that there were reasons for the termination wholly separate and apart from the complaint, if it happens right after the complaint, it just stinks to high heaven. And a court can sometimes deny summary judgment based primarily just on the timing, because it's just such a red flag when it happens that way. Of course, you know, my view is sometimes employees know, it's just, you know, like your kids, they know when it's getting, you're getting ready to lower the boom, right? You know, my son was great at it. You know, whenever he just pushed me to that point where I was just like ready to lose it, he'd say, "I love you, Mommy." So employees are not that different. You know, they feel it coming. And so, you know, it may be that that's when they come out with their complaint because they feel like, if I'm going to get fired anyway, I might as well tell them what's going on with me and what's happening to me. Or it may be that they're setting up. I don't know. It's always interesting to hear how many times managers or supervisors who get accused say, "I was just getting ready to fire him." Like, yeah, well, did you put that in a memo? Well, no. Did you tell HR? No. So sometimes I've actually gotten lucky, and they say, actually, HR and I did discuss it, and we'd already notified payroll, and we were in the process of doing the paperwork. We just hadn't met with the employee. I'm like, yes, don't anybody touch that stuff. Don't anybody touch it in the file. Don't touch the computer and documents. Leave the dates there so we can prove that the decision to terminate was made before they filed their complaint, right? So that becomes very, very critical, that timing, because if you can prove